Great to have you along today with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Glad to have you along. Allergies are something that many of us deal with. For some people, they're more of a nuisance than anything, but a severe allergic reaction can actually be life-threatening. Dr. Mary Morris is with Allergy Associates of La Crosse. Her father founded the practice in 1972, and Dr. Morris started working at the clinic at age 13. The clinic is internationally recognized as a leader in sublingual immunotherapy as a treatment for the causes of allergies, not just the symptoms. And she's joining us today from our studios in La Crosse. Dr. Morris, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
So let's talk about kind of the basic terminology first. What exactly is an allergic reaction?
It's a response that is inappropriate to something that's normal in the environment. So, for example, most patients or people can stand outside on a beautiful day like we're having today and have no problems, and another person can have itchy, runny eyes, sneezing, and even asthma from the just normal things that are in the environment.
And so how much of a range is there in the severity of allergic reactions?
It goes from absolutely no response at all to, as you had mentioned, life-threatening types of reactions. From airborne allergies, typically the more severe reactions are those that affect the lungs. But there are people that will get swelling of the areas around their eyes, they'll get hives. All sorts of different types of reactions can happen.
And is it the same mechanism that produces allergies, say, to a food item as something like pollen or mold?
Typically, they're all misreactions of the immunoglobulin E or IgE type symptoms that triggers the whole cascade of things that are released and cause symptoms.
And what are the main kind of groups of things that people are allergic to? You talked about airborne illnesses, foods. Are there particular substances that a lot of people are allergic to versus some things that are very rare but still very serious for the people that are allergic to them?
The most common airborne allergies are to things like dust mite, pollen, including ragweed, grass, and trees in our area, molds, and animal danders. Those would be the most common airborne things. With foods, interestingly enough, there about 8 different foods are what trigger allergic reactions in 90% of food allergic people. There are things like egg, milk, wheat, corn, yeast, soy, peanut. Tree nuts and shellfish are also although they're not as common, they're the ones that are the more likely ones to cause life-threatening type reaction.
And I know this wording really isn't correct, but how does your body decide what it sees as a threat? You know, say a peanut or say, you know, avocado or say dander from a cat. How does, you know, an individual body decide this, you know, decide this is a threat, I need to react strongly to this?
That's actually an area that I have a really strong interest in. I don't think anyone knows exactly when things go wrong and why the immune system heads one direction instead of the other direction. But we do know that, especially with food allergies, there are things that happen at a very, very young age with exposure to the mucosal immune system, specifically the types of tissues in the mouth and under the tongue that seem to help the body go in the right direction, the development of tolerance to those foods, rather than in the wrong direction where they develop an allergic response.
So early exposure can actually be helpful for avoiding some reactions.
There's a new way of thinking that perhaps waiting too long in a baby before we introduce certain foods actually may cause an increased risk of development of food allergies. Hmm. The studies are still fairly early on, so I obviously wouldn't tell anyone to disregard what
Sure.
the pediatrician tells them. But I think it's an area that in the next few years we'll have much better advice with young babies and hopefully we'll be able to decrease the risk of food allergy development.
And how does that knowledge and that research play into the thinking about airborne allergens? Do we tend to have more of an, how would I say it? If we're exposed to certain types of trees, plants, you know, where we grow up, it seems like for some people, those still cause allergic reactions, even if they've been exposed to them since they were very young.
Right. I think the food issues are different than the airborne issues. And the reason I am fairly comfortable with saying that is with the food allergies, the incidence has gone up drastically in the last 10, 20 years. Even in the last decade, the incidence of serious food allergies in kids has been escalating at what would be referred to as an epidemic rate. When I think back to when I was a kid, I remember there were a few people that said, oh, I can't eat that. But now if you go to virtually any elementary school, you'll see signs posted, you know, no peanuts allowed. Those types of serious reactions have really increased in the last decade to two decades.
That's really interesting because that was my sense, but I wondered if we were just talking, you know, sometimes things are the same as they always were, but it's more out in the open or people are talking about more, or it's being addressed more. But what you're saying is that there really has been a very noticeable increase in those food allergies in children.
Right. The CDC did a study, I think, about a year ago, and the incidence truly is higher. It's not just that we're doing more testing or recognizing things at a milder stage. One thing that I think is interesting about the allergy community is they have, since the 1950s, had different sites around the world that have done periodic testing in children. I think at second grade and fifth grade, for example, in Australia, all over the world, there were different sites that were used that would do skin testing, but also collect blood samples and save them. So we do have a sense of, okay, this is truly increasing in incidence. Mm-hmm. It's not just our imagination. Now, I don't think the same is true with airborne allergies. I think those are actually fairly consistent, at least over the last 20, 30 years. The types of allergies have been the same. And I think the incidence is probably about the same as well. We certainly haven't seen the huge increase like we have in food allergy.
It's really interesting. It'll be very interesting to see what theories emerge about the food allergies because, yeah, it really does seem like there's a very marked increase in the number of kids. And I assume, do food allergies tend to stay pretty consistent through a lifetime?
Unfortunately, things like peanut or tree nuts, once you've developed them, the incidence of their just going away on their own is actually quite rare. Mm. Things like egg and milk are quite likely to be outgrown, but those serious tree nut or peanut allergies unfortunately persist throughout the rest of that person's life.
Is there a typical age when allergies tend to emerge?
Well, for airborne allergies, we often talk about the allergic march or the atopic march, where children usually about age 2 or 3 start to show signs of allergies to airborne things like dust mite. Then there's sort of a set progression. At least here in the Midwest, we don't typically develop pollen allergies until about age 4, 5, or 6. Hmm. And I think that's because in our part of the world, they're intermittent. You know, we don't have grass pollen all year round.
Right.
So the children in our area typically 1, 2, 3 seasons, they don't have symptoms. And then with that 4th or 5th year, unfortunately, that's when their immune system starts to recognize those pollens as foreign and develops allergic antibodies against them.
I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller today, talking with Dr. Mary Morris of Allergy Associates of La Crosse. We're talking about allergy causes, treatments, and some really groundbreaking work that the clinic in La Crosse is doing. If you have a question for Dr. Morris, please give us a call. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Marika Suval will be answering the phones. And you can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org. And Dr. Morris, we have Diane in Pulaski on the line. Hi, Diane.
Hi, thank you for the program. I suffered from allergies and hay fever for most of my adult life, and now I have a situation where I don't know if it's an allergic reaction, but to perfume, I can't stand the smell of it, and my tongue, as soon as I smell it, and I don't wear perfume, but anybody else around me, I smell it, and it gets on my tongue, and I have a burning sensation. Do you know what that is?
Well, there are patients that have sensitivity to chemicals, and that sounds like perhaps that's what's going on with you. There are tests that can be done for more contact-type allergies. We'll do patch testing to figure out what that chemical is. But it is a possibility that the perfumes themselves have some chemical in it that is causing the reaction.
And Dr. Morris, you were talking earlier about the types of allergies that do or don't get worse or emerge later in life. Is this unusual that suddenly, Diane, I'm not going to ask you your age, but I assume you're an adult.
Yes.
And this just developed recently.
The perfume thing recently mm-hmm. developed, yes. The other allergies I've had for a long time.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, Dr. Morris, if you have a patient that presents with that kind of recent reaction to something, would you think that it's something new with the body, or maybe this is a chemical that person hasn't been exposed to before and now is reacting to? Where would you start with that?
I think that the people who have chemical sensitivities usually have significant allergies to other things as well. One connection that I sometimes see is the people that are allergic to molds tend to be the ones that develop sensitivity to chemicals. I don't have a really good explanation. It's just a common observation that I see. I also have found, though, that with a lot of the chemicals, we don't have the ability to actually treat for them or desensitize for them. There are only a very few that it's possible to specifically treat for. But oftentimes getting the other allergies under control, getting those decreased, will give you more room to work with, as I say. With allergies, everything add up. So anything that you can do to modify the other exposures may give you less reaction to the chemicals.
Diane, is mold one of the things that you're allergic to?
You know, I don't know. I've never been tested, but usually it's just like the pollen and like hay fever and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I also lately have seen more and more patients who are really deficient in vitamin D, and correcting that vitamin D deficiency sometimes will also help with their chemical sensitivities.
Okay.
Vitamin D is one of the few vitamins that you can actually take too much of. So I don't recommend that you just take a large amount of it on your own. But you might want to check with your doctor and see if perhaps a blood test could be done to see if you are truly deficient.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks for that
You're
call,
welcome.
Diane, and good luck. So, Dr. Morris, I want to go back to something that you said in answering Diane's question. It sounded like you were saying that if your immune system is kind of in overdrive because of other allergies, and then there's a new irritant or allergen that's introduced, that again, I'm probably oversimplifying, but it sounds like your immune system is already kind of like revved up and ready to go. And so if it detects something else that it sees as a threat, it's kind of got all guns blazing already.
That is exactly right. You said that exactly right.
Well, that's good, because I would hate to mislead anyone. Well, we had a Facebook comment from William. He said, as a youth, I had what was called hay fever and wasn't able to cut the lawn. Although I have to say that sounds a little suspicious. But he says, I slowly grew out of it, and also some of my other allergies. Today, I'm still I still take over-the-counter meds, but find that the more I exercise, the less I depend on my meds. Is there a connection that you could see there, Dr. Morris?
I am unaware that exercise can specifically help the airborne allergies. I do know that, I don't know how old of a person that is, but sometimes in people's 20s, some patients actually do have improvement with their airborne allergies. Just, I don't know if it's changes in hormones or exactly what the mechanism is. But unfortunately, sometimes it will then recur when they're in their 30s and 40s. So, I don't know how old of a person he is. I'm hoping he's older so that those allergies definitely have gone away. But sometimes we see a bit of a reprieve, and then it'll come back strongly again later.
We're talking about allergies, detection, and treatment with Dr. Mary Morris of Allergy Associates of La Crosse. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Dr. Mary Morris with us from our studios in La Crosse. She is with Allergy Associates of La Crosse. And Dr. Morris, let's go back to the phones and Maria in Madison next. Hi, Maria.
Hi. I just had a question. You kind of a little bit alluded to the answer in the last with the last caller, but I used to break out in sort of these hive type. The allergy would present with like hives all over, mostly like my face and just my neck, anywhere that the like air would touch my skin. And when I would go see the allergist, they usually, if it was bad enough, they would give me prednisone. And that would be just when it was like almost like an anaphylactic reaction. Otherwise, you know, they would give me like cortisone, creams or whatever to try to help. But anyway, I never really found out what was causing it. And I just was wondering if you'd ever heard of anything like that. And oddly enough, now it's in the last year or so, I haven't seen any of it. So I wondered if it was stress related or, hormone. I am premenopausal, so maybe, the hormone thing kicked in or something. I don't know. I just was never able to get a clear answer, and it was very debilitating, especially working, working. It was just, my face was just like welted and just almost puffed up,
So, Dr. Morris?
Did they do actual allergy testing for you?
They did. Yes, they did. And
find anything?
Well, it was like, they said trees, and it was sort of the normal things like trees and grasses, which I've kind of had a history of allergy, but in an eczema form earlier in my life. And then this kind of just started when I was like in my late 20s, and it's been for like the last 15 years. Every spring it would come, and this would show up, especially when it was like blowing out like today. Or like the grass, when the grasses and the trees, I think trees were a real big problem, but maybe it was just that, and how it showed up on me. I don't know.
So can something like those airborne allergens, Dr. Morris, cause hives? I mean, it sounded like Maria was thinking it was actual contact on the skin, but could that just be how the body is reacting?
People can actually get contact hives from airborne pollen. So things like trees or grass, it is possible to develop hives on the face and neck. Typically, they're in the exposed areas. So, for example, they wouldn't cause hives on the belly or areas that weren't exposed to the air.
Mm-hmm. So Maria was just those areas?
Neck, that's possible.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Sure.
Okay.
And let's go to Heidi in Watertown next. Hi, Heidi.
Hi. Okay. So I'll give you a little brief history and then my question. Last year when I was pregnant with my third child, I had gotten like reoccurring sinus infections over and over and over. So I finally went to an ENT and he's like, well, you probably have allergies, but we can't test you right now because you're pregnant. So take a 24-hour Claritin. I take a generic loratadine, I think it's like 10 milligrams. And once I started taking that every day, problem gone, which is wonderful. But now, baby's 6 months old, I'm still taking it. And I feel whenever I, miss even a day, it's like sinus pressure comes back immediately. I can just tell that I'm starting to feel the sinus stuff come back. So then I start taking it again. And my doctor said I can't really be tested for allergies until I'm done nursing. And I guess the one side effect I've noticed, and I don't know if it's in relation to taking the loratadine, but my sense of taste seems to be dulled quite a bit. So I didn't know if that's a normal side effect, and is there any long-term dangers in taking an over-the-counter medicine like this?
Dr. Morris?
The loratadine has been around for a long time, so I think I can say that safety isn't going to be a concern with continuing it as you have been doing. 10 milligrams is the approved dose, so that I'm fine with. I do wonder, though, if your decreased sense of taste is actually more related to the underlying allergies than it is a side effect of the medicine. We can see with recurrent sinus issues, people can actually develop polyps that can decrease their sense of smell, which therefore affects their sense of taste. So the ear, nose, and throat doctor is the one that does the assessment for that. I do actually do testing in patients that are pregnant and that are breastfeeding. I typically won't do much in the way of skin testing, which is, I think, what they're referring to when they're saying they can't do it then. But there are actually blood tests that are available for even airborne allergies that, in my opinion, maybe aren't quite as sensitive for things like mold allergy. But if things are positive through the blood test, then for sure they're an issue for you.
Okay.
So you might want to just check with your primary doctor if they could at least do the screening test through the blood.
Okay.
They're called specific IgE levels.
Okay.
And they can be done for things like dust mite, cat, dog, ragweed, grass,
okay,
different trees. At least then you would know what you're dealing with.
So, okay, let's say I was allergic to one or more of those. Then what do you do for a normal treatment for those allergies, because they're just...
It depends
everywhere
on what you're allergic to.
Okay.
For example, if you're allergic to something like dust mites, there are things that you can do, like getting allergy covers for the mattress, allergy cover for the pillow, washing sheets and pillowcases in hot water, getting an air cleaner, changing your filters more often. Those things can actually decrease the amount of exposure that you have. So environmental control measures like that would be number one. With pollens, you know, it would be hard to completely avoid them, but certainly running air conditioning will help filter the air before it comes into the home.
Okay.
So I think it's helpful to know what you're allergic
sure
to, so you know how best to handle it.
Okay.
But
well,
then
I
if
plan
it,
on doing that.
But then if it's something that you're allergic to that you can't avoid, then I think immunotherapy is something I think it's an incredibly powerful tool that actually treats the underlying problem for allergies.
And actually, let's take that opportunity to explain the immunotherapy model that you use at Allergy Associates of La Crosse. Tell us, Dr. Morris, first, what the traditional way of treating allergies has been and what the immunotherapy approach is that you take.
Well, immunotherapy is actually a quite simple concept and something that's been around for 100 years, which is the concept that we figure out what the person's allergic to, and then we give them a very small amount of it in a controlled way. And then as they gain tolerance to it, we just keep giving them more and more, basically to train their immune system to not react. I think most people are familiar with allergy shots, which it's the same concept that's been around for 100 years. For example, if you're allergic to dust mites, we take a small amount of that extract, and most commonly once a week would give a shot of what that person's allergic to. And then after several months, once they're up to the quote, maintenance concentration, then they oftentimes can decrease that frequency down to perhaps even once a month. And at the end of 3, 4, 5 years, most patients then, their immune system has been trained well enough that they can actually stop allergy shots and still maintain that benefit. So that is the traditional way that immunotherapy has been done in the United States. But about 40 years ago, my father, who was an allergist, thought there were a lot of patients in our area that are allergic to mold, that when he tried to give them injections for mold, he actually made them worse. So he thought there's got to be a different way of getting the same benefit without the side effects. So he was a real pioneer in developing what is referred to as sublingual immunotherapy, which is allergy drops put under the tongue with the same exact extracts that are given by injection, but smaller amounts more frequently. And he found that he could get the benefit without the side effects by doing it that way.
Hmm. And so your father pioneered this, and what kind of results have you been seeing over the years since Allergy Associates of La Crosse started using this?
Well, we've had very good success at our clinic. We've treated, I believe, about 130,000 patients this way. So we have, I think, the largest experience in the whole world with
quite a bit of data to look at.
Quite a bit of information. But as things develop, which I think is always funny. In Europe, this started being looked at about 15 years ago. And over the last 10 years, very, very good research has been done on sublingual immunotherapy in the rest of the world. And the studies there show that the efficacy is the same, meaning if you're allergic to grass, shots or drops work well. But the safety is superior with the drop way of doing it.
And why is the safety superior?
In the rest, it's a smaller amount that's put under the tongue rather than injected into the body. And the immune system, when we put things in the mouth, develop tolerance rather than have allergic reactions.
Hmm.
So it's just the root that is safer.
And how many people in the U.S. do we estimate suffer from allergies? Is there good data on that?
Yeah, it depends on who you listen to. The lower estimate is about 10% of the population. Higher estimates are about 20% of the population.
So looking at like 35 to 70 million people.
Yes. Wow. Huge number.
That's a huge number.
People that suffer from allergies.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we have an email from Brent in Merrill. He says, I'm allergic to shellfish. It came out as a child eating lobster. I remember eating shrimp as a child before this with no reaction. Presently, I can eat clam chowder and it doesn't bother me. What in shellfish triggers an allergic reaction? And is there some kind of treatment or medicine to take so I can enjoy shellfish like shrimp?
Part of the shellfish that causes problems most commonly is something called tropomycin, and it is common amongst all the shellfish. Clams are kind of a cousin rather than a sibling, like shrimp, crab, lobster would be more closely related. Although the general consensus is it's best to just avoid those, and I actually think it probably is, that is easy enough to avoid that I would recommend that people just stay away from it. I have had just a few patients that have had shellfish allergy that I actually have treated because of occupational exposures that they weren't able to avoid it.
So for instance, working in a kitchen or something.
Correct.
Hmm.
Chefs, primarily,
chefs, yeah, that would
where
be,
they
that would
had
be tough.
To handle it. They had to be in contact with it. Even if they weren't eating it, they were having hives and things. So I have treated a few patients, but it's a matter of, is it worth the expense to go through a course of immunotherapy just for that?
Mm-hmm. Whereas something like pollen or dust or something that you really can't avoid, it probably is, yeah, more worthwhile to spend the time and the attention on getting treated. We're talking about allergies, the diagnosis, the treatment, the causes, with Dr. Mary Morris of Allergy Associates of La Crosse. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can always leave a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show, and Mueller is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. And let's go next to Pete in La Crosse. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Judith and Dr. Morris. Lucky for me, the last time I was stung by a bee was probably over 30 years ago, but I had a pretty evil reaction to it. And now I'm kind of wondering, this many years later, am I likely to have a reaction? Can I be tested for it? You know, what are the chances I grew out of it? So can you talk to me about adverse reactions to bee stings and what to do to make sure I don't end up getting a terrible reaction someday in the future and be ill-prepared for it?
Sure. Thanks for that call, Pete.
How young were you when you had the bad reaction?
I'm thinking I was about 15 or so.
Okay.
Wait, definitely less than 20.
Okay. The reason I ask is there is a subgroup of children that will have had a bad reaction when they were very young that will actually outgrow it. Usually, though, by teen or adulthood, if you've had a bad reaction with a stinging insect, you still are at risk many, many years later. And I urge people to be tested so they know if they are at risk or not. We can do testing by skin testing, or we can do screening tests even through blood work to help see are there high levels of those IgE allergy antibodies against specific stinging insects. And one of the things that has been hugely successful with immunotherapy is actually treating people with severe stinging insect allergy. It's one of the conditions that actually has one of the best success rates of any allergic condition.
Hmm.
So getting tested, knowing are you at risk, for sure checking and getting an EpiPen if you are at risk, and then considering immunotherapy for it. That is actually one of the few areas where I do recommend allergy shots. I think the data is the best for curing people with stinging insect with allergy injection immunotherapy.
Okay, I'll follow up on this.
Good. Great. Thanks for that call, Pete. And actually, Dr. Morris, that brings up a question. Treatment at the clinic at Allergy Associates of La Crosse, are there insurance companies that cover that, or is that always an out-of-pocket expense for someone who might want to follow the immunotherapy option?
Typically, the visit, testing, those sorts of things are standard. So I would always tell somebody to check with their insurance company first. The allergy drops, though, are not covered by insurance. Those are an out-of-pocket expense.
Okay. And let's go next to Wendy in Platteville. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. Hi, Dr. Moore. My question
Hello.
Is... Hello. Hi. I got a son, he's 9 years old, and he's a type 1 diabetes. He's allergic to dust mite and pets. So he's taking pills, and I was worried about that. Will if he take these pills long-term, will they have side effects, especially being he's a type 1 diabetes?
Okay, so he's 9 years old, he has type 1 diabetes, and he's allergic to dust mites and also pet dander. And so the concern is if that long-term medication is going to be a problem. What do you think, Dr. Morris?
I don't believe there's any concern in people with type 1 diabetes with any of our allergy medications. So antihistamines, even topical steroid nasal sprays, for example, we use those commonly in people with type 1 diabetes.
Okay, good, because this is my big concern.
Sure, especially starting so young.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's right. And do you got time for me for another question?
Sure.
Yes, I myself got quite a few allergies, and I developed when my in middle age, kind of. And will that, hard to say. Will that also cause my son have allergies?
So basically, will your allergy history be
I never had it when I was young. Okay. Until 5-6 years ago, it started. And I have lived in this country for 11 years.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So are things that Wendy is developing as an adult, is that likely that her son will then develop things later in life?
The genetic tendency towards allergies is well known. If one parent has allergies, the risk to their child is about 30% that they will develop allergies. If both parents have allergies, it's about 80%.
And is that allergies to the same things, or just they have a tendency to have an overactive immune system?
It's the tendency towards an overactive immune system. Remember how we had talked about little children? They usually get, 3, 4, or 5 years of exposure before they develop an allergy. Mm-hmm. When someone moves to a different country or a different part of the country and there are new pollens that they're exposed to, typically the same thing will occur with them, that it'll be a few years before their immune system starts to realize, oh, there's something new here. Mm. That maybe I'll develop an allergic reaction to.
So that's interesting, because I lived in Russia for a year and I don't react really at all to mosquitoes here. I grew up in Chicago and living in Madison. Midwestern U.S. mosquitoes, I barely even notice if they bite me. There's no big welt, doesn't itch, anything like that. In Moscow, when I would get bitten by a mosquito, it was like somebody had slugged me. I would get these huge, itchy red welts. And it was a constant battle in hot weather in Moscow, because there were no screens on the windows if I wanted air so I could sleep, or if, but that meant getting bitten, eaten alive by the mosquitoes. And I reacted so strongly there. It was really interesting.
And when you came back, are you okay with
I'm
mosquitoes?
Fine with my familiar mosquitoes. Yeah, no problem.
That's
at all.
Interesting.
But it was it was embarrassing going out after after a night of getting bitten, because I was just, I was a mess.
Oh,
so, but
sad.
It was fascinating, though. I tried to look at it as a little scientific experiment I was running on myself. Well, I think we have time for one more call, so let's go to Beth in Brookfield. Hi, Beth.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I have probably one of the most strongest histories of being allergic to practically everything. And as a very young adult, I tried shots, but I got so disappointed in, the quantity that I was taking and the frequency, that I stopped them. And I just now just live with my 8 weeks of misery. And I'm real curious about this sublingual. And I'm wondering, is there anything in and around the Milwaukee area that anybody that does this besides La Crosse?
Mm-hmm. So are there other clinics doing this, Dr. Morris?
There are other clinics around the country that do use sublingual immunotherapy. I'm trying to think of the quickest way of finding. I think if she went to allergychoices.com, there's a physician directory. I think there is an ear, nose, and throat doctor in Kenosha who actually does some sublingual immunotherapy. The other thing that I was going to mention is, I think the FDA is probably this year or certainly by next year will be approving sublingual immunotherapy tablets. I don't know the inner workings of the FDA, but I know that there's been a submission already for GRAS immunotherapy tablets. Once it's FDA approved, then certainly any allergist or ear, nose, and throat doctor familiar with doing allergy testing and treatment may be able to offer that to you.
Great. Well, thank you for that call, Beth. And it sounds like while this is a fairly revolutionary treatment right now, that hopefully with all the good data that you've been gathering over the last 40 years and what's going on in Europe, that it will become more widespread and be another option. I appreciate that you were saying that, in some situations, like with the bee stings, that you still recommend the traditional shot therapy. So I think it's great to add another, tool to the tool belt for people to use in combating allergies.
I agree.
Well, Dr. Mary Morris, thanks so much for spending time with us. And I'm sure there's more we could talk about, and we'll have to save it for another program.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
Dr. Mary Morris is with Allergy Associates of La Crosse. They are internationally recognized leaders in sublingual immunotherapy as a treatment for the causes of allergies, not just treating the symptoms. She joined us from our studios in La Crosse. And joining me in the studio right here in Madison are two of our favorite guests. We're switching over to talk about the weather next with the UW Weather Guys. It's always a fun and informative discussion when they come by, so stay tuned here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.